Well, it's a pleasure again to be with you this evening. We appreciate the presence of everyone who has come, and we hope that our time together will be beneficial, that we'll learn some things that will help us generally in our Bible study. The particular lesson that we're going to talk about this evening has to do with the nation of Israel. I have chosen that as a segment of material that I think we can talk about and get several things under consideration in the amount of time that we have. I wanted to mention to you that when we're talking about this from an archaeological standpoint, we're talking about the Iron Age. This has to do with the tools that were used by the ancient people, the material out of which they were made. We begin to find iron in the neighborhood of about 1050 or 1100 BC. We believe iron was brought from Turkey, maybe to the Greek Isles, and then from that brought into the area of the Philistines, which settled on the southern coast of what we know later as Israel, Canaan at the time. And then at that time, we read in the Bible that the Israelites had to go down to the Philistines in order to get their plows sharpened. They had some metal, but they couldn't sharpen them. And so they had some pieces of weapons that were made out of iron at that time. So it's the Iron Age. Before that was the Bronze Age. And before that was the New Stone Age. And before that was the Stone Age. So the materials that people use are used by archaeology to describe the period. That happens until you come to the Hellenistic period. And then it's no longer the material, it has to do with the people, the Hellenistic or Grecian, and then the Roman. But in our Bible study, we call this the period of the nation of Israel, the period of the united and divided kingdom. And most of us have spent time in Bible study from our small ages, small grades, discussing this sort of thing, studying about it. And we think of that as the divided and the united kingdom first. I want to mention that when we come to this particular period, it is a very controversial period among archaeologists. And I happen to have this photograph that Luke Chandler shared with me because he had worked at this place called Kirbet Kiyafa and in fact is going back in a couple of weeks to work again. And the director of the dig there is a man from Hebrew University called Yossi Garfinkel. He's a professor there. And you see him there on the left. And the wording on his shirt says the Elah Fortress. This is a place that overlooks the Valley of Elah. And they have found there evidence of a city belonging to the time of David, that is, to this period that we're talking about, the beginning of it. And so he is one who is more or less spearheading, there are several others, who are spearheading the idea that we have evidence that there was a nation of Israel, that they had planned cities. In other words, it was not just sort of a tribal thing, that a group of tribal leaders were here and there in the country. And this is very significant because if you look on the other side from Tel Aviv University, so it's Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University, and as far as I know, almost everybody who's at Hebrew University in Jerusalem holds with this more conservative view. But there are those who hold a more liberal view, and most of the professors at Tel Aviv University hold to that concept. And the idea is that we don't have any evidence that there ever was a Solomon and a David. We don't have any evidence that they ever had a city that they built. We have no evidence whatsoever with regard to the things that are recorded in the Bible regarding the United Kingdom. So this is a real controversy. And in the Shephelah, sometimes it is pronounced, this is what in our English Bibles is sometimes translated the lowlands. It is the territory in the Bible that is, as you go down from the mountains of Judea toward the coastal plain, you go through a series of lowlands. Well, that's where the Valley of Elah is located. That's where this Kibrot Hatzaphah is located. It is where Gat, or we might say Gath, is located. And it is where Bet Shemesh is located. All of these are cities that have something to do with either the Israelites or the Philistines. And so we're learning a lot about that, and there'll be more and more to talk about in the years to come. When we think about this period, we think about kings like David and Solomon. We don't have a lot of information from the time of Saul. We know something about the palace that he was building at Gibeah, which is right on the north side of Jerusalem of that day. Right now it's within the city of Jerusalem. And this city of Gibeah, where he was located, there was an iron instrument, that is, it was a plow point that was found there by the excavators a number of decades ago. And then when we come to David, though, we begin to pick up some more things, and Solomon and so on. But the date of this is from 1050, that is, this period we're dealing with is from 1050 BC down to 586. 586 was when the Babylonians took away all of these people, or many of them, and destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And so you have a period of time there, it's called the Iron Age, and then archaeologists split it into periods like Iron 1 and Iron 2 and Iron 3 as we go along. David was chosen by God, and his kingdom was established forever. Now, all of the kings of Judah, you remember when the kingdom divided, there was Israel in the north and Judah in the south. These came from Judah, the tribe of Judah. David came from Judah. And so you have all of the kings from the house of David. Every king from David to the time 586, everyone was from the house of David. But in the north, that was not the case. In the north, they came from a variety of tribes, and none of them were from the tribe of Judah, and none of them were from the house of David. But that's what God had said. God had told David, I will establish your throne forever. And so that is what is under consideration. Now, I see that on the chart here I have 597. That's actually the last right king, that is lawful king. And after that, after Jeconiah was taken away, then there was somebody who was put in his place. He was still from the tribe of Judah, from the family of David. And we'll talk about that in our lesson next Wednesday evening, and you'll understand a little more why I have put that date there. Well, these people who were we call them the minimalists, they're people who do not believe the biblical accounts at all. They think we have no evidence whatsoever for a kingdom of Solomon and a kingdom of David prior to that. And when we come to this discovery that I'm going to share with you first, it is one that really deals with this a great deal. And it is from the city of Dan. Dan is in the far north of the land that Israel lived in. You remember the expression, from Dan to Beersheba, from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. What you see here is a tell. That's where the trees are growing up there. And then down below that, you'll see a wall. It is a restored wall. It is only partially as high as the original wall. Where you see the group of people over on the right, they're going in through a gate, and there's a kind of an entry there. And then they come to a real gate, a gate that is, I believe it is, six-chamber gate. And then after you go past that, you go up to another gate, and then you're on top of the tell. So it was a well-fortified city that the Israelites built there, and very significant. In 1993, the last day of the dig, this dig was conducted for maybe 35 years by Professor Abraham Biron of Hebrew University, and he demonstrates what we like to see, and that is that somebody spends a lot of time somewhere in order to see what's there. not just to go make some discovery and then run off and say, well, we found this or we found that. But he spent all of this time, 35 years or more, and was active in this excavation all of those days. I have heard him speak about this. He's deceased now, but he talked about this discovery. This discovery happened on the last day of the dig in 1993. Archaeologists typically work for 2 to 4 weeks, sometimes 6 weeks, at a given site. The reason for that is because the weather, it's because the professors are busy teaching at other times, it's because the slave labor, the students who come to help, are also in school at other times. So this is a very important thing. And so when we say that he had worked there 30 years, it doesn't mean continuous, but it means during 30 different archaeological seasons, which might last 3 or 4 weeks or 5 or 6 weeks at a time. Well, an Aramaic inscription was found, and here is a photograph of the real thing. You see 3 pieces of material here. On the right, you see the piece that was found in 93. Since it was the last day of the dig, they could not continue. All the plans had been made that this closes the dig. And so the next year, when they went back, they found 2 more pieces, the 2 that you see on your left. And this inscription is referred to as the House of David inscription, the House of David inscription. What I'm showing you here is a reconstruction of that. That is a replica like you would see in a museum. I mean, the real piece is in the Israel Museum. And then this is at the Horn Archaeological Museum in Barren Springs, Michigan. But you can see the letters maybe a little bit better. Hebrew reads from right to left, and it has a very interesting message on it. Though it is not complete, it has a lot of interesting things. This inscription provides us with the first external reference to the House of David. The House of David. Now, what do we mean by that? Look further what we have here. This mentions Hadad, who was the Aramean god of storm and warfare. Now, when we say Aram or Aramean, we're talking about Syria. Most of us in our Bible study, we would say it was the Syrians. But in the Hebrew, it was the Arameans. Then when the Bible was translated into Greek a few centuries before the time of Christ, Syria was the term that was used in Greek, and so they used that word. That's the way it's come to be in our English Bibles and the way we still talk about it. There is a mention of the king of Israel, and there are several passages, 2 passages at least, in the Old Testament that might serve as the background of what is under consideration here. So look what we have. We have a reference to the House of David. We have a reference to the King of Israel. And we have a reference also to Hadad. And Hadad was the god of the Arameans. And you remember from your Bible study that several of the kings were named Ben, you remember that? Ben-Hadad. You see, they named themselves after the god that they served. And so we have here 3 different nations that are under consideration in this little inscription. We have Syrians or Arameans. We have Israel, the northern kingdom. And we have the House of David. Okay, let's take a look at a passage or so that might help us to understand this a little bit better. I mentioned already, after we read 2 Kings chapter 12, we talk about the Davidic dynasty. We talk about how the kingdom was divided, and in the north we have Israel, but in the south we have David and his descendants that are ruling in the country. So take a look at this passage in 1 Kings chapter 15 and what it sets forth for us. We don't know that this is the passage under consideration, but it could be, and it does illustrate the same thing and helps us to understand an inscription like this. Ben-Hadad was the king of Aram, or Syria. Baasha was the king of Israel in Samaria. And at Jerusalem, Asa was the king of Judah. Now, here's what occurred at that time. The Bible tells us that Baasha was in alliance with Ben-Hadad. You know how nations make alliances. This is a big deal still today, just like it was then. So you got to have your friend here to put between you and your enemy there. All right, so Asa is in a bind because he's got Egypt to the south, always a threat. And on the north, he has Baasha and Ben-Hadad against him. Baasha is coming down to the border with Judah, or really the border of Benjamin, which is a little area that is just north of Jerusalem. You can go 12 miles from biblical Jerusalem, and you've come to the kingdom of Israel. That's the way it divided. So you have only a small area north of Jerusalem that is controlled by the people of Judah. Baasha comes down and starts fortifying the boundary. So what are you going to do? Well, Asa was a smart man. He was a diplomat, it seems. He went up to Syria and he made an arrangement with Syria. We'll work together. Now who's caught in the middle? Now Baasha is caught in the middle. See what we're doing here? And now what does Baasha do? The Bible says he withdrew and no longer built the fortified walls and so on that he was working on. Look what you have here. You have a king of Aram or Syria. You have a king of Israel. And you have a king of Judah. All three kings are involved in this particular incident that we're talking about. I'm going to skip this. This is another possibility. 2 Kings chapter 8 does the same thing, where you have a Ben-Hadad and then Hazael, who took another name, and then Joram of Israel and Jehoshaphat of Judah. It's the same principle, same idea that we are talking about. This is a drawing of that first large piece that was found. And you see on the line I have pointed to here, reading from right to left, you see that there is a dot at the beginning of that. Then you see that there's a letter that is an angle and has three points down. This is the way we write. We make one line and we put two out and that's an F. We put one here and it's an L. We put three, one shorter than the other, and that's an E. This is the way we still write. We just draw lines, and then we draw one and put it around like that, and it's an O. See, so this is not so strange. So that is the equivalent of a H in this Aramaic, or Hebrew, we might call it. And then the next two letters are the same, and they look like our delta in Greek. Almost everybody can read the fraternities and sororities and the way they make their letters. And so here's a delta, and that's the same equivalent. That is daleth in Hebrew, so it is HDD. Now, what is HDD? Hey, Dad. You see? So you got to add some vowels to it. There are none in Hebrew. So you add some vowels to it, and it becomes Hey, Dad. Now look down further where you have the longest line and notice that there's a dot on the last of that word. And the word here is Melek. There are three letters, M-L-K, and then there's a dot, and then Israel. So, king of Israel. So you have a king of Israel. Well, that means somebody who's ruling over a kingdom called Israel. Somebody who's ruling over this territory that is called Syria or Aram. And then come on down in the next line and you have a dot. At the end of it, you have another dot and it says Bet David. It says B-T-H and then D-V-D, David, Bet David. Okay, now, did you remember those dots I mentioned? What were the dots for? The dots divided words. If we wanted to divide a word, we would put a space. Remember that? We did that in school, didn't we? Don't run your words together. In New Testament times, in Greek, the Greek that we have, the early manuscripts that we have, they all run these letters together. And so you have to be very careful and make sure that you know the word that's under consideration. I mean, it's not easy. But here you have Bet David. What is Bet? Or we say Beth. The Jews don't pronounce the H sound. The H sound. Like Germans don't either. Lufthansa airline, not Lufthansa, like we might say it. And so what is this that's Bet David? Well, somebody said Bet means house, like Bethel. They would say Bethel. Beth Shemesh is the house of Shemesh. So this is what this means. It's the house of somebody. But look at it. It is not the house that belongs to Steve. House of Steve. It would be house dot Steve. Right? Like an email address. But it's not that. It is Bet David. One word. What does that indicate? It indicates that we're talking about a kingdom, a dynasty that is called the House of David. So in this context, where you have Hadad of Aram, that's the god, but we know that the kings were named that, I've already mentioned. We have House of Israel. We have the Melech, or the king of Israel, rather. Melech is king, like Melech Zedek. Everybody knows that. In the book of Hebrews, in the 14th chapter of the book of Genesis. Only we don't say it that way, do we? We say Mel, Kiz, Edek. But it's really two words, Melech Zedek, which means, you know what it means, king of righteousness. All right, so here you have the house of David, you have the king of Israel, and you have a king or somebody that is representing or spoken of that belongs to Syria. So this illustrates that there was such a thing as a Davidic dynasty. If you're going to have a Davidic dynasty where kings following David are going to be called of the house of David, that means you've got a kingdom. And so this is a total response to these people who were saying that there is no evidence that we have of any kind of a kingdom of Judah or even a kingdom of Israel. And this document demonstrates that we do. You know that the kingdom divided when Solomon died in 931. And you have Israel in the north, you have Judah in the south. And I want to talk about something that happened shortly after that. When there is a civil war or when there is a division, it is easy to go in and take advantage of the people. And this is what the Egyptians did. They were a threat, you know, always to the people of Israel. And in 926 BC, that's just a few years after, 4 years after the division, 5 years, and in 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 25 and 26, the Bible says, in the fifth year of the king Rehoboam, he's the king of the south, Jeroboam was the king of the north, that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem and he took away the treasures. So it tells us that the Egyptians made an excursion into the country and took away the treasures that were there that had been amassed by Solomon. And of course, you know, in reading the Bible about Solomon, he amassed great riches. He was somebody who had alliances with so many of the nations and kings around him and was able to do that. Well, I said to you last week that we don't always use the word confirm. We just say this illustrates. But here is a case where really we have a confirmation by another source. I hear them saying on TV a lot that we're reporting this, but we do not yet have confirmation from it from another source. They want to have at least some other independent source before they say, it really is so, it really happened. And this is the case here. We have this confirmed by a triumphal relief in the Temple of Amun at Karnak in Egypt. We learn something about the excursion that was taken by this king, Shishak, or Shishank, it's sometimes pronounced in Egypt. And you can see the route there on the map. You recognize Beersheba and Arad, and you recognize also Jerusalem, of course. That's the place where he took away the treasures. And then you look to the north as far as Megiddo in the north. And when you talk about that, you talk about Shechem, you're talking about the kingdoms of the north. Shechem, Tirzah was the second capital, the first permanent capital of the northern kingdom. Then after that, they moved to Samaria. But now they're at either Shechem or Tirzah. Looks like maybe at Tirzah because that's where the king goes as well. And so he takes these places and he records it when he gets back to Egypt. If you have been to Egypt, you can see this place I'm talking about called the Temple of Amun. The god Amun is the god, A-M-U-N or A-M-O-N, sometimes it is spelled. And this is in modern Luxor. It is ancient Thebes. We read about it in the Bible and other sources. And so when something happened at Thebes, this is where it was. This is the way this temple was built. This is just the entry into it. And you see that one side is higher than the other. I don't know why they never did it the other way. It looks finished on both sides, but it's not that the other side was, one side was unfinished. That's just the way they built the temple. You have these ram-headed gods, or they are representations of gods, as you go in. This is Amun. And then when you go in here and you go out to one of the outside walls, you see this. And what this shows is the god Amun, that is the ram is the representation of Amun. But here you see on the wall a representation of Amun. And Shishak is recording all of this and telling all of the things that he did. You may notice in this that he's holding one hand, the left hand, down. I'm going to show you a larger photograph in a moment. He has lines going out to all the different kings that he says he conquered. Now, we think of king today so many times of a large territory. But you know from reading the Bible that it was often a very small territory. Like each city, each small area would have somebody called the king. And that's what you have in this particular case. And so here's what we see when we look a little closer at this portrayal. You see, he's holding something in his left hand. I think I said that wrong a minute ago. And then in his right hand, he's holding the lines, ropes, or chains that are going to. And what are they going to? They're going to cartouches. There could be a woman here tonight that has a cartouche around her neck. You bought it in Egypt, or somebody bought it for you, brought it to you. And what it is an oval shape. And in that oval shape, in the hieroglyphics, this pictorial writing, it tells the name of the city. Every city that was taken. Altogether, there are 156 of these cartouches that are on this wall. 120 of these have been read, at least 120. The others are partly damaged, and you can see that as you look at some portions there where it looks solid, like it's been smoothed over by plaster or something to simply show you that we don't have that particular information. And we have a lot of these cities, 120 of them, that are from Israel and Judah. So here's something that is recorded in the Bible, and it is also recorded in the Egyptian records, a very significant point indeed. Well, about that same time when the kingdom divided, there was a king in the north named Jeroboam. And Jeroboam, the Bible tells us, set up gods in the north. The record tells us that the king consulted and made two golden calves. He made set one in Bethel. Bethel is right on the border, 12 miles from Jerusalem. So that's real close. And then he put another one all the way in the north at that town we talked about, Dan. So he got one at Bethel and one at Dan. And what does that mean? Well, he said to the people that you don't have to go to Jerusalem anymore to worship. The Bible records that a lot of the priests that were living in the north, a lot of the Levites, left and went to the city of Jerusalem. They wanted no part of this. And that's one way to understand something about why these people continued to go away further and further and further until they were taken away into captivity by the Assyrians in 721 B.C. But now he's put up golden calves. He said, this is the God that brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Very interesting, isn't it, that he would do that. It says also that he built houses on high places. Now this can be several things. One, it can be built on a hill, on a high place. But it can be that just anywhere he chose, he would put in a high place. The high place was used as a place of worship of the various gods. We see these in excavations. I don't have some of those photographs tonight, but we see those in cities at the gate. One that's an illustration of that is a town that might be Bethsaida or Bethsaida in the New Testament, but it is probably of the land of Geshur. It is of the land of Geshur in Old Testament times. Whether we know the exact city, we're not sure. It's not far from the Sea of Galilee in the north. And there, as you enter, you can see an image that was found. This image was placed there so that the person who goes to worship can bow down, present his worship. Maybe there in some instances would be incense or something else. You go inside the gate of the city and you look, and there are these small images. They are usually about the size of a small tombstone like you used to see in a lot of country cemeteries. And you find these at the corners. The prophet Ezekiel talked about that later on in the days of the people of Judah. When in fact, on every corner, he said, you're worshiping these at these places. So it was a sad thing, but this was the beginning of it. And it reminds us, of course, of what happened when Israel came out of Egypt, doesn't it? That there they built a golden calf. We're not told anything about this. There are two golden calves. We don't know anything about the size of them as to how large they might have been. Well, we think that this high place at Dan was discovered also by Professor Biron, I mentioned a moment ago, and that this is something of very great significance. Here is the large platform that's right on the top of the tell, almost like the high place of the tell. And whatever other buildings were erected there, we don't have them anymore. The god didn't have to be all that big. That is, the calf didn't have to be all that big. It's what it represented. And so if they had a structure there where they would keep this, and then people would go to worship, then they could bring the calf out. We're talking about just a golden calf of whatever size. They bring it out, people worship, and then people go about their duties. All right, look at something else. Look below there, the altar. The foundation of the altar is there. I could show you more pictures and explain this more fully, but you can see the foundation exactly where it was. And so what they have done is to put a metal, kind of stainless steel or something, they've put that there, showing horns on the altar. The horns look something like this. You see, so that you can go to those and take hold of the horns of the altar. It was that way in the biblical temple. And we read about Joab going into the temple and taking hold of the horns of the altar, probably the one on the outside, you know, the burnt offering. And it provided asylum for him. So we see this in various illustrations. We have a lot of little altars like this that have the horns. Some of them are one piece, made of one piece of stone. And then down at Beersheba, we have a large one that was made of many stones, and it also had the horns of the altar there. So you come there, there's a priestly caste. These people, to them you make your offering. They then assist you, or they go with you, or maybe they go for you up into this place. We don't know exactly how it happened. Here now is that frame where the altar stood. We know it was that size. In the very left of the picture there, down closer to the bottom, you'll see it looks like a hole, kind of like we have somewhere here at 138th Street, I heard on the news. And so we've got this hole right there, but when you look in it, it's pottery. And this is the place where they kept the water or liquids that were used in connection with the sacrifices. So when they went to this place to sacrifice, they had an altar. They found all kinds of bones of animals here. They did not find any pig bones. You see, these people had gone so far away from... I said the wrong thing. I'm thinking of something else right now. But Israel would not, if they're faithful to God, they're not going to have any pigs. But here you would find animals that were considered unclean by the law of Moses. And so they would find just the right shoulder, for example, the right wing of some birds. Lots of these were found. And the meaning of that simply is that here we have these people who are coming to worship. It was a worship different from the worship that God had ordered in the city of Jerusalem. And this was always a conflict with these people as well. Another view of the high place, just to give you some idea of the size of it there, as you see the steps that led up to it. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about these bulls and how significant they were in the ancient Near East. We often see images like these that were in front of the museum at Aleppo, Syria, almost to Turkey. It's the largest town now in all of Syria, before a lot of people were killed recently. So we don't know what size it's going to be when that's over. But what you see here is kings or rulers standing on the back of bulls. See, the bull holds them up. The bull represents power and strength, and so they're being held up by that. We have also found, when I say we, I'm talking about has been found in our time, we know about the Apis bull of Egypt. Many years ago, I was able to go to the tombs of the Apis bulls near the Great Pyramids. It stayed closed for decades. And I understand that just recently, actually maybe since all the problem in Egypt arose a couple of years ago, it has opened. And whether there's anybody there to go see it, I don't know. But there you had large sarcophagi made out of granite, which Egypt is famous for, down at Aswan. And these were cut out and a mummified bull was placed in them. This was a special bull. They did this at Memphis and Saqqara for about 500 years. Where would the Israelites, where would Aaron have gotten the idea, well, let's make a bull right after coming out of Egypt? Well, because bulls were worshipped in Egypt. We are so much influenced by our society, and yet many times we deny it all along. But others can see it. Others can see what's happening. And so here, as this portrayed in the British Museum, and I see these bulls in a lot of museums. I make a habit of going to museums that have collections that have to do with anything about the Bible world. and I have a number of photographs of this, but this is one of the neatest ones. It shows both the worshiper and the bull as he is being worshipped. In Samaria, the northern kingdom, not in the city, but in the area of Samaria, from the 12th century BC, this bull was found. It's small. It's not very large. Probably could be 5 to 6 inches high. And you can see again that it's been plated in its bronze. It may have been plated in something that's more precious than that. And so bulls were used. And then look at another one. This one was found at Ascalon. And they not only found the little bull, which was 4.5 inches long and 4 inches high, it looks like that it was placed, it has, if you'll look at the feet of it, you'll see that there's something underneath the feet. That was to put it on a board or a piece of something so that it would stand up. And then you have the sanctuary in which it was actually found. This is the way they did. Lots of these sanctuaries are found that the various gods that were served by the people were put into the sanctuary or into the shrine, you could call it. Okay, so you go there and what happens? The priests now have taken care of all this. So you go to worship and the little calf, this is actually a calf, and the little calf is just sticking his head out the door. That's enough. You can see, you can worship whatever was involved in the worship, and then you can go on your way and you're faithful for another year or whatever. And then the first of the year, you put away the nativity scene and the baby Jesus. And you know, when I see this and I see what people do today and how they make so much of Jesus, and then after that, Jesus was something was back in December. And this is the way it was in those days as well. Look at the age of this, from 1600 to 1550. That is even earlier in this case. And so we have illustrations of that. Well, let me see where I am and how much I think I might cover. I've forgotten. Do we stop at 5 till? 10 till? At 10 till. I had better go to, let's go to number 37. I think we'll have a little time there. Maybe I can do this in the 5 minutes. As we come toward the end of this northern kingdom, we are in the Assyrian period so far as nations of the earth are concerned. And the Bible makes reference to that a lot. For example, in Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 5, the Lord said, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation." When these soldiers came to the city of Lachish, you see them as they have their slings, they have the large baseball-size stones that they're using, and they're ready to throw those at the enemy, that is the Israelite on the wall, or the Judean that happens to be on the wall. In 853 BC, the king in Israel in the north was Ahab. Ahab was not a good king for the Lord. But Ahab got involved fighting the Assyrians in 853 BC. It was at the Battle of Karkar. That's the picture of Karkar, the tell right there. This is in northern Syria, almost to Aleppo. I've had the opportunity to go into that region of Syria one time, and so it's an interesting place. On this satellite map, you can see Karkar. You can see Aleppo. I called attention to the museum a moment ago. Look on up further on the Euphrates River, you will see Carchemish. Very famous battle between the Assyrians and the Babylonians took place there in 605. And then look down at the bottom of the map, and that's where Samaria is. That's where Ahab lived. And there actually is a way to go. In other words, there are valleys that you go through. You go through where those two White Peaks are. One's the Lebanon Mountains, the Anti-Lebanon. You go through the Bekaa Valley. You go on up through the entrance of Hamath. You take the valley on up. I know this. I've seen this. And so you go on up there and you go to Karkar. Now, Ahab gathered together with 11 other men, 11 other kings, and they decided they would go up and fight against the Assyrians at Karkar. Look what happens now. The Assyrians made reference to this. Shalmaneser III, in this battle, claims that he defeated 12 kings, including, and he calls him Ahab the Israelite. He says that Ahab provided 2,000 chariots and 10,000 foot soldiers. Now, there's one very significant point here. Not only is this a reference of Ahab, the king of Israel, but of all the kings that were listed, all 12 of them, this is the second largest army. We talk about how many we've put into Afghanistan, how many the Spanish put in, how many the Polish put in. But who's the biggest? Well, we've been the biggest always. And then there might be somebody else, though. It might be Britain, it might be Poland, that have had others in these places. And so Ahab was a much more powerful king than maybe we have thought. We read about his bad things, but he had a pretty powerful nation here. All right, now here's Jehu. And Jehu was the king of Israel in the days of Shalmaneser III. And he is pictured on this, it's so-called a black obelisk because of the material that is used. They cleaned it off a few years ago in the British Museum and found it wasn't quite as black as they thought. It was just dirty. And so when they cleaned it, they saw that it had a lot of grayish color that was coming through. And on one of the sides, one of the panels, you can see a king who is bowing down. And this king is bowing before the king of Assyria. And that is pictured as Jehu. It could be Jehu, it could be one of his representatives, his ministers, and he's portrayed there, and it tells about the various gifts that were received from them. I'm going to have to stop right here. I wanted to tell you further about something that happened. I'm just going to do it quickly because I won't have an opportunity again. But at a place in Lebanon called Dog River, you see a water flowing out there into the Mediterranean. And there's the river. And up high on the cliffs, this is a place that ancient kings came. In fact, modern kings come here as well, modern leaders, when they have a battle in that region anywhere, as recent as 1975 in the Civil War in Lebanon. And up high there, these kings, starting with Ramesses II of Egypt, more than 1,200 years before Christ, and then Shalmaneser III, they have left a picture of themselves or an inscription. And so here you see them, and then this is a closer view as you take a look, and that's Shalmaneser there on your left, and here's a larger photograph of him. He's holding up one hand, and then on the other side, that's the Ramesses II. It's much more worn than this one. But it's amazing that after all these years, and in one of his records, Shalmaneser said that when he was at Dog River, that there, this place overlooking the sea, that there he took tribute from Jehu, the son of Omri. The Bible doesn't even record this. But these kings that we read about in the Bible were real people, occupying real places. This story, all of these stories are the truth. Thank you so much.